Welcome to the Errata Movie Podcast. Today we're talking with filmmaker David Gordon Green about his new film, Snow Angels.
You want to have all the awkward smiles and moments that even the strangest tragic circumstances can have.
This is Robert Davis, and I just want to apologize right up front here for the last couple of weeks of episodes. We've had to yank them, actually, from the site. 2 weeks ago, we thought it would be a great idea to get Jean-Luc Godard and Steven Spielberg together in the same room, hash out their differences. Seemed like a good idea. Just did not expect that it would be so acrimonious. We put it up, you know, we thought it would have historical value, if nothing else, but it was clear after the feedback started rolling in that the level of filth was just beyond what we could and should and would normally allow on this podcast. So we took it down, deleted it from the archives, and you have our apologies. The next episode, last week, we expected that J. Robert's interview with Carol Burnett would be totally different, but my God, that woman is bitter. And J. Robert was just relentless. I mean, relentless. I know he says he doesn't drink, but did he not sound plastered to you? Is it just me? So that one's down too. We took both of them down, one for one for legal reasons, the other just out of taste. So I want to apologize. Today we're talking with filmmaker David Gordon Green, who's a very laid-back guy, and so I don't expect we'll have any trouble. Fingers crossed on that. He does, however, have three surprises for us. Let me enumerate them for you. Number one is his new movie called Snow Angels.
We got a little girl missing.
It's Annie's daughter.
Where have you been?
When's the last time you saw your daughter?
I would never hurt Tara.
I didn't do anything! I didn't do anything, okay?
I couldn't sleep last night thinking about Annie. Made a
mistake in my life. Where's my wife?
Glenn, will you go home? Lost
in he used to make me laugh.
People don't stay the same.
It's easy to block out the things that upset us. It's what most people do.
I have bad dreams, Father God. I have really very, very bad dreams.
I think I like you.
Now, David Gordon Green sort of burst onto the scene in 2000 with a little movie called George Washington. It doesn't have anything directly to do with the President of the United States, but it's about sort of working class African-American community in North Carolina. It has this kind of meandering, amorphous plot, not much of a plot, and one sort of emerges in the end. It's been compared to Charles Burnett's film Killer of Sheep. Other people compare it to Terrence Malick's first movie, Badlands. So it's that's a pretty odd blend right there, but those are both apt comparisons. He made a couple of movies after that, one called All the Real Girls and Undertow. All of them take place in the South. All of them sort of have the same odd quality. Something about it is poetic, but something about it is improvised. It's hard to say exactly. So surprise number one is his new movie called Snow Angels. It's surprising because it takes place in the snowy North, for one thing, but also it seems very carefully constructed, which might surprise people who have seen his first three movies. It's based on a novel by Stuart Onan, so some of that structure may come from there, but I feel like he really made some astute changes to the novel. It's very faithful to the novel, but what he altered, I think, is very telling about the way he constructs movies, and I think that it's surprising if you thought that structure was not his strong point necessarily. I guess the other thing that's sort of surprising about it is just how difficult it has been for me to figure out what I think of it. My first reaction was that it was sort of a trite indie tragedy, you know, this march toward a terrible, horrible ending. And it is that, and yet there are some things I just can't dismiss about it. Like, for example, it's beautiful. There's this perpetual snowfall that seems like death, but it also seems cleansing and beautiful. You know, it's a really great-looking movie shot by Tim Orr, as all of his movies have been shot by Tim Orr, a guy he went to film school with, and who has established a reputation, thanks to Green's films, as a guy who makes really beautiful movies. But also the weird thing about it is that as a counterpoint to this sort of tragic story, there's also a tender teen romance. I saw this movie over a year ago at Sundance, where teen romances are a dime a dozen. But this one was by far the most realistic. It's really tender and sweet. And it seems even kind of bold to give this story as much weight as the tragic story. But they're woven together in a really delicate way. The other thing that's really strange about what Green has done is he casts unusual people for this movie. People like Sam Rockwell and Amy Sedaris, people who you wouldn't normally think of as being in a really heavy movie. But they're good. And they even have some light scenes in a movie that no one is going to consider a light movie at all. You know, on a previous podcast, we talked about a movie called The Savages, which I consider a drama, but it was marketed as a comedy. But it's not a mystery to me why someone might try to spin that as a comedy, because it has some funny elements. Nobody's going to try to spin Snow Angels as a comedy. It's just really dark. So it's, again, a bold and odd and strange and unsettling decision to have such light actors in this movie. So I guess what I'm saying is, in some ways, this movie is a typical odd blend from David Gordon Green, and yet he has gone a different direction with all of his oddness than he's done in his previous movies. So I think it's a surprise, and it's probably a surprise to anyone who would not have guessed that he could handle a large ensemble so well. Surprise number two is a movie he has coming out later this year. His fifth film is, believe it or not, a big-budget stoner comedy produced by Judd Apatow and starring and written by Seth Rogen in his first big role since Knocked Up. So that's a surprise. The third surprise is the movie he's doing next, if everything goes as planned, but I'll let him tell you about that at the end of this interview. Please welcome, joining us by phone today, David Gordon Green.
Hello, Rob. How you doing?
Good. Thanks a lot for making time for this. I know you're traveling and stuff, so I appreciate it.
It's actually the first time I've been able to talk. I had a jaw surgery, so I'll be spitting all over the phone.
Oh, really? Well, I hope you're not tired of talking about Snow Angels, too. So I know
I haven't even started, so we'll see how it goes.
Okay. Well, so I'm curious about it being your first adaptation. Your films always have this sort of loose and almost improvisational feeling. How did it feel working with someone else's story?
I kind of needed the discipline of it at that point, because I think everything I was writing at that time, I was kind of just plotless and pointless and crazy and tangential and stream of consciousness. And so, I don't know, I thought it would be interesting to work with some structure that had already kind of been engineered and that made sense in the series of characters and relationships that, I felt were very accessible, but still I could bring kind of intimate qualities that I like to inject into them. Yeah. So for me, it was great because it was like, okay, I got a blueprint and then I can mess around and go crazy within it. And it was a book that I really responded to. I initially wasn't doing it intending for it to be a directing gig. It was literally a writing job for another director. So I guess it was kind of an evolutionary emotional attachment I kind of took to it through my job as a writer. So it's weird because nothing I ever do really is ever what it was intended to be, and that certainly was the case with this one, where it was, you know, I'm trying to picture it based on another guy's vision, and slowly I kind of find my own personal attachment to that, but I also have the splinters of my own concept that my heart's kind of latching onto.
Right.
So it was an interesting process, but I love the book, so adapting it was an opportunity to focus and amplify the parts that I thought were great and cinematic, and there were characters and scenarios, obviously, within the adaptation that you dismiss or you put to the side or make a little less. And you know, like, for example, the book was a period piece that took place in the 70s.
Yeah.
And I'm sure for the author writing the book, that anchored it in a sentiment that he personalized, that you know, put it in a sentimental time period for him, where, you know, I was like 2 years old, so I was trying to find things that I could identify with and give it somewhat of a contemporary yet timeless setting.
Right.
So I took those kind of liberties. It was really satisfying a few weeks ago when the author saw the book or saw the movie for the first time and seems to have given it a seal of approval and was genuinely excited about it, which to me is kind of baffling how someone could take your creative product and kind of throw it into the blender, which is what any movie making process is,
yeah,
with casting and locations and adaptations and all of that, and to come out with something that he could stand by and feel like was a genuine interpretation of what he had designed, I think is a pretty awesome pat on the back.
Yeah, definitely. It almost seems like maybe the two of you had similar personal experiences in some way, too, if you were able to take two different approaches to similar material, you know.
And I think from some of his other writings, too, I feel like we do have a similar sensibility of humor and emotion. We probably had equally kind of messed up childhoods that created the beast that we have become. I can't really direct anything. I can't communicate with an actor unless I've personalized it, unless I know where they're coming from and what they're trying to say, and unless, in some strange, perverted way, those voices are kind of coming out of me. And I think that happens instinctively for any writer as the characters are kind of creating themselves and the story's kind of telling itself, is that your voice comes out of them.
Yeah.
So by the time there was actually a ghost script, it was a lot of the stuff from any of the characters, you know, from older, younger, male, female, whatever, I kind of felt like I had personalized it all enough where I could identify with them enough that I could communicate successfully with the actors, which was subconsciously the goal.
One of the changes from the book is that the book is sort of these two strands sort of woven together, but they stay at a distance. You brought them a little closer together by making Glenn and Annie know each other now. Or sorry, not Glenn, Arthur and Annie. They work in the same restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
What was the idea there?
In kind of my efforts of making things that felt kind of, that had a flow to it, so I could have it not choppy, not feel episodic, not feel like I'm doing a back and forth kind of parallel action between, I mean, there is to some degree, there's a parallel between the two love stories, but I didn't want it to be so abrupt that I actually did some of the draft that way, and I felt like I was holding these two relationships up and comparing them. And to me, I want that to be a subconscious little meditation of like, you know, love as it begins and love as it ends. But I didn't want it to be so dissected as it was feeling to me when I was writing it that way. So I felt the way to avoid that was to integrate them so they kind of come float in and out of each other and the stories were a little bit more woven. You know, I changed kind of some environmental elements of it to make it less of a statement on some of the working class elements that I think were in it before. You know, nobody works at a junkyard and tried to upscale them. You know, in order to get a movie like this going, you need a solid actress for a role like Annie. And to get a movie like this financed, you need somebody that kind of brings not only the juice of the talent of the performance, but also the name and somebody that makes sense to a financier when you're proposing a movie. So the second you throw Kate Beckinsale into a, you know, burger joint or whatever, you know, it wasn't going to work that easily. So tried to kind of make things make a little somewhat of a practical sense in terms of financing and in casting. But at the same time, I also was just personally looking to, I'd spent three movies in the kind of dirty blue collar, you know, dirt under the fingernails kind of working class world. And yeah. I thought, in addition to breaking out of the South, I thought it would be nice to kind of break out of that and bring it a little bit more into a middle class vibe.
Yeah, that is another big difference in this film is that it's snowy.
Exactly.
And it's cold.
But that's intentional because, you know, when you start, anytime you make a movie that anyone's in any way receptive to, the next movie that comes across your desk in terms of anybody's proposing you to employ you is the exact same thing, but just a little different, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a very conscious decision. It took a little while to get out of the kind of Southern crybaby genre, which was, in terms of writing jobs and adaptations, is what I was making a living doing for a few years. I mean, in terms of directing, I just wanted to not do that, just so I didn't get so pigeonholed and I could open up a few professional doors for myself.
Yeah.
But I'm impressed that you read the book, because it's actually refreshing, because when I finished the movie about a year ago, I actually reread the book, and it had been 2 or 3 years since I'd read it, and it was kind of amazing for me to go back and see where all these ideas had come from, but then how I'd kind of splintered off and had gotten rather self-indulgent in some of the characters and personalizing things.
You think you were self-indulgent?
Yeah. I mean, I have to be to write, otherwise I'd, you know, don't want to do it.
Yeah.
If I don't have some sort of personal investment in something like that, you know,
yeah,
writing as a job is like a real, and I've had a couple of those where people just pay you to do something you don't want to do. That's terrible.
Yeah.
A, I suck at it. But B, it's just like, you have to like discipline yourself to sit down and really give yourself that regimen, where to me, writing is, it's not, I don't know, it's amazing that anyone would pay you to sit down and do something that you enjoy.
Yeah.
And to truly enjoy it, I got to find some sort of identification or something. There's got to be an excitement. I mean, I write crazy shit too. That has nothing to do with anybody's personal life, just random genre stuff. But it's got to be fun, and I've got to find something that I'm eager to do rather than just something I got to pay a bill to do.
Yeah.
If I was going to have to do that, I'd rather get a regular job where I didn't have to think so much.
Well, yeah, I think this is one of those rare cases where I think the movie feels really faithful to the book, and yet the book, I don't know if it's just that it allows room. Like there's a scene where Glenn approaches Annie's house and they have this whole big exchange, and it's sketchy in the book. I mean, there aren't a lot of details in the book, but that gives you and Sam Rockwell, I guess, this room to sort of what really was said here and how did it work, you know? So I guess they dovetail well.
And I haven't read that script since before we started shooting it. Like literally, I'll tell you the wonderful thing about having a book, aside from, you know, my job as a writer and the psychology of what I'm setting out to do, is you get that. I mean, in a book like that I trust, because I've adapted a couple books that are just not good books, and you're just trying to make them better. but that was a great book that had a lot of value as a reference. So I just had the actors read the book and read the script, and the script kind of told the scenes and the elements of the book that we were going to be doing, and but they had the depth of the book that a script's never going to be able to achieve, because you're trying to do it in 115 pages.
Yeah.
So the actors read the book, and then we improv. Anytime Sam and Kate are there, we're just—it's what's coming out of their mouths as a result of us talking about it, designing some characters, and then using the book as a reference. So it's not heavily scripted in terms of what you see at the end of the day.
Yeah.
Which is great to have the book, just so that they can, like, I mean, I know when Sam's like saying prayers and stuff like that, none of that's in the script. It's just stuff that he got from the book and kind of latched onto and wanted to flesh out a little bit.
So even though the material is really heavy, I can imagine that with people like Sam Rockwell and Amy Sedaris on the set, that things weren't always serious.
No, every single actor in it, from Tom Noonan, Kate Beckinsale, Amy, Sam, Nikki, I mean, everyone is hilarious. Michael and Olivia, like, I cast all funny people. I mean, and Kate in particular, and she's not known for her comedic roles, but like, she just cracks you up on set all day, which makes it a ton easier when you're going to be going to some of these really emotional places. Because, A, your communication and your relationship with these people is that much stronger, and you're not intimidated by each other. And there's something that I feel almost far more intimate about laughing with people than with crying with them. Because crying almost feels dirty in a way, sometimes when you don't know someone very well. When you're laughing, there's something that's connecting everybody. You know, the room is, everybody's engaging, and when people are crying, people get scared, and they separate, or they feel obliged to put a hand on a shoulder or something like this.
Yeah.
And for me, it was just great to build a strength based on enjoyable people that like what they do, that are there for the right reasons, in a movie that they're not really getting paid much for. And you're freezing your ass off, so you don't want to go outside and pace around and get particularly, you know, entrenched in sometimes the dark corners, and there's no... Well, then we did have trailers. This is my first movie to have trailers on it, so that was a retreat that I think was kind of new.
Huh.
But for the most part, it was just a real kind of engaging community of people all kind of spending a summer up in Nova Scotia, or a winter up in Nova Scotia.
Did you cast funny people on purpose?
Yeah, I don't like jerks and serious people that much. I mean, they're okay, they're funny. I mean, serious people are funny in their own respect, but like, if you're sitting there for months and months with a great, you know, a job that you're passionate about doing, like, you gotta have a good sense of humor about it. And so, yeah, I pretty much only cast funny people in movies, even when they're not comedies.
So
some people just take jobs so seriously that it becomes, again, it's just like work. I just like to have fun. So it's a little different, I guess.
So how do you think that affected the movie?
Oh, it helped the movie, because it wasn't so, a project like that could end up in the hands of the wrong actors and directors. I think it could be a soap opera. you know, and you want it to be funny. You want it to have all the awkward smiles and moments that even the strangest tragic circumstances can have. I mean, I do anyway, because who wants to go sit there and watch a sad movie? Like, yeah, I'm going to see a sad movie. Like, I want to see the movie that, like, is actually people dealing with life and the frustrations, but also you see that they're human beings and these little elements that make everybody's lives interesting, the fact that we're all here dealing with these circumstances that may be frustrating or upsetting. It's all just kind of part of the adventure for me.
What are some, what's an example or two from the movie that sort of seeped in because of the just sort of humor of the environment?
Perfect. I have a perfect example of something, because there were often, and we have a comedy version of this cut, or the cut of this movie that you probably don't want to see, but for example, like when the young girl goes missing and the search party's on and Nicky Cat's character is elsewhere, and then when he shows up kind of to the house in a hurry because he sees cop cars outside the house of Andy's house, and he rushes up there and he's running, and then literally in the take, the actor slipped on ice and he fell on his ass, right?
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, and in reality, what we filmed was one of the funniest falls you've ever seen, because literally his legs are kicked out from under him, and it's just the funniest looking physical comedy in the middle of a very intense, suspenseful moment that we were trying to find the line of, like, how much of that do we show? Because it's amazing, and it shows the kind of clumsiness within a serious circumstance that I think is insightful to, and it's just one of those accidental bricks of gold that fall in your lap every now and then.
Yeah.
And so it was literally to find the frame that didn't feel inappropriately comedic, because we tested a version of it where it was like people would just laugh at it because it's so funny looking, and it's a tension breaker. I mean, you know, you see that movie, and you see that in any movie from, you know, Hotel Rwanda, The Last King of Scotland. Anytime something minorly humorous happens, you get a huge laugh because it's such a release.
Yeah.
And the crowd needs that kind of humanity in that. And you want that. I think it feeds the drama of the movie, honestly. But you don't want to betray the drama of the movie. So it was literally in editing room, finding the frame that gave you the human imperfection of the moment without giving you the hilarity of the moment. And so that's what it was a lot.
It's also the kind of thing that could and would really happen. It's not like it was concocted for...
Exactly. It's not clever. It's just strange. It makes you feel uncomfortable as a viewer, and a lot of people's instinct when you're watching something uncomfortable is to giggle, just because it's a defense mechanism, I think. And when you're in a crowd of 300, 400 people watching a movie together, like, I at least, when I'm watching my own movies, like, I'm very conscious of where those giggles are and who's giggling and why. You know, you get very self-conscious of it. Like, you go to a sophisticated New York, you know, they've seen everything that's every art film, every pretentious anything, and they can butcher a movie that I think is actually. I've watched movies with some of these crowds that the crowds are really rough on a movie that's actually really beautiful and it's got a really subtle, like, it makes me feel like smiling, but they're laughing real loud and aggressively that makes me feel like they're actually hurting the movie for other people. You know? So, I don't know. I mean, it's always interesting. Every new audience, every new region is a new adventure, but trying to find what gives a movie humanity without giving it hilarity, I guess, is what I was trying to gauge on this. And you've got the balance of it's someone like Amy Sedaris, which I didn't want, you know, we don't want Strangers of Candy. We want what is this kind of beautiful, warm humanity within a woman, and bring something totally different, totally reinvent anybody's expectation of her within her look and within her performance.
Mm-hmm.
So she was one where we really were conscious to make it feel likable, but not outwardly comedic.
Right.
And Sam, too. Sam is, you know, he's done so much funny stuff, and he brings, and what I think is kind of a beautiful baggage he brings to the role is his comedic, likable roles of the past, from, you know, Confessions to Matchstick Men or whatever kind of, he's got such a great body of work and diverse work that you want, that the whole time you're watching his character on this kind of downward spiral, you want him to get stronger because you like not only who this character is, but you like where Sam comes from.
Yeah.
You want Sam to clean up his act.
Did you see the movie Joshua?
Yeah.
That he was in? Yeah. I liked him a lot in that.
Yeah, and I think that was really smart casting. I remember when he was talking about doing that, he shot that movie right after Snow Angels, And he was like, yeah, I guess I'm kind of on this new phase of trying to do things that are a little bit off of what people are offering me, trying to get something that's a little, that gives me a little bit more range. Because on the stage, I think he's known for being at a lot more of a diversity of performances. But in film, he's just now getting started, I think, and showing people what he's about.
What's the deal with the red hand?
Good question. The red hand in the, you know, on the wall and then the paint.
Yeah.
I remember the point in production where I said, hey, wait, we have two red painted hands in this movie. And it was literally in production when I was talking to the art director about it. In the book, the Glenn character goes to a cemetery and writes me in the snow.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a beautiful gesture, but really heavy on the nose for what I was trying to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the significance of a character referring to, I mean, literally just writing me, or somehow you reference that character's inward look at himself. So I was trying to plant me on Glenn somewhere, and it may have been my production designer's idea to do that. If you like it, I would credit Richard Wright with it. If you don't like it, then it's all me.
I did like it. I'm just glad that you didn't say what red hand. I don't know what you're talking about, because I have not read anything about that, and I was starting to think I imagined it. But I was sure I saw multiple red hands.
Because a really good friend of mine who reads into movies a lot more than I do, because I don't try to guess who the killer is. I watch movies and just enjoy what's happening, or I hate them. You know, I just kind of go for it. But I have a friend that really interprets and gets into the symbolism of things. And he said, oh, I love the red hand motif. And I was like, oh, you caught that, you know, just to see what he'd say.
Uh-huh.
And he said, because everyone has blood on their hands.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
You know, and I thought that was kind of a beautiful, I mean, and you know, I should have kind of BS'd my way through this conversation and said, yeah, that's what it was. But I kind of thought that was pretty interesting, but it was coincidental. But it does, you know, I think there's a lot of things that work their way in the movies, certainly into mine, that at the end of the day kind of look cool when you kind of emphasize and recognize and amplify in the editing, but were either subconscious or unconscious decisions during the writing or production of it. And there's a lot of those things, and the more I'll watch a movie, I'll find these little links and think, hey, God, I wish I was smart enough to have realized what happened there, but I don't know.
Well, the scene you mentioned from the book is where he writes me in the snow is also one of the few like direct references to snow angels.
Yeah.
What is the title? I realize that the title of the movie comes from the book, but you could have changed the title. You kept the title. What does that mean to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I never had a snow angel scene in the make anybody make a snow angel scene in the movie, and Sam kept wanting to make a snow angel in the movie. But literally the very last shot of the movie that we shot while we were in production, I was like, okay, Sam, we got like a little bit of daylight left. We'll film you making a snow angel. I filmed it and didn't make a movie. Wasn't particularly interesting. I mean, to me, it is kind of. I like the title. I mean, I did honestly consider changing the title because since when I realized that it wasn't going to have anything directly significant, because again, it kind of feeds the people that are reading into things in a way that if I don't have a specific justification of it, and I feel kind of like an idiot. But in this case, I was like, I'll just say it was what the book was called. but it does, I mean, for the book, I think it works beautifully at blurring the childish physical gesture that is making a snow angel with an adult, in the way that it makes it an adult activity in that. So it brings the childishness out of an adult character, which is what we tried to do through the whole movie, is make the Glenn character like a broken little boy that just never could get growing up. And it also kind of just has that strange, mythical, spiritual element of just kind of the mystery of life and death. So to me, I think in the book, the way it's kind of illustrated, it works in terms of being a movie where everything is so magnified. I thought it was going to be a little heavy-handed to do any direct reference to it. But to me, yeah, basically it's just about adults acting like kids and not in a fun way, in a damaged way.
Right.
Because I think it's a sad scene in the book. When he's doing that, it's like it makes you cry because he's connecting with not only, you know, whatever the movie reveals as its interesting plot twist, but also he's connecting with his who he is, which is a kid that can't grow up, that doesn't know how to deal with the frustrations and obstacles that life's thrown at him.
Yeah.
The defense mechanism is just to, you know, do a cannonball off the high diving board, basically, which is what I used to do.
So the other movie I wanted to ask you about was Pineapple Express. Where are you with that now?
Well, I will tell you the beautiful music element that we're done with the movie as of whenever Huey Lewis and the News finish recording the theme song that they are writing. That is the most amazing thing you've ever heard. we're totally done with it. It comes out in August, I'm excited about getting it out there. In terms of a year where you have a movie, I can't be more proud personally of a project than something like Snow Angels. In terms of what I've been able to accomplish in my career, when I look at Snow Angels, I feel really, really great about what everyone had to offer from the cast and the crew. I feel like, okay, we got it, and we did what we set out to do, and I feel really good about it. And then to have an opportunity on another planet of comedic and action and financial possibilities as Pineapple. I mean, to actually have a studio-sized budget and to be able to do what your wildest dreams think you should maybe do today. It was a great experience to do those movies back to back, and it's going to be a funny year to have my name attached to two things that are attractive to absolutely opposite audiences.
Uh-huh.
And it'll be interesting that the weird middle ground of people that actually will have the audacity to investigate both.
Yeah, it seems like a real change of pace, but I get the feeling that you're a filmmaker with lots of different potential movies, types of movies in your head.
Yeah, that's the hope. Like, my agent doesn't even know how to deal with me anymore, because he'll have, like, an idea that he thinks is, or something will come across the desk in terms of my name on it, and I'll be like, absolutely not, when he'll think it's an obvious fit. And I'll be like, the obvious fit is, like, for me, is the wrongest thing. Like, the most exciting thing that could happen for me is to, like, do a direct-to-video Steven Seagal movie next, or a documentary about some political or cause that I'm passionate about. Like something that I haven't touched on, something that I haven't even exercised.
Yeah.
Like I love that idea of just going not, because I feel like for me the proudest I am is when I approach things naively and can bring an instinct to things without overanalyzing it. And once you've done three movies in a selected genre or region or under a umbrella of plot, you're not as naive. You kind of know what works, you know what doesn't, you know what's fun, you know what sucks. And to me, half the adventure of it is going to a new place and trying something new.
So do you have any idea what the next one will be?
Right now I'm working on a horror movie, which has been real fun. Yeah, and it's totally different. I'm going to go to Europe. I mean, to me, I would like to go and just make a beautiful horror movie. I'm a big fan of horror, but like the last few years have just kind of been littered with like stuff that just makes you not want to look. I'd like to make a scary movie that made people want to watch and sing a song.
Are there horror movies that you like that are like that?
Not yet. Well, Silence of the Lambs to me plays like, people I guess put it on the thriller shelf, but to me that movie's truly horrific, but also so creatively engineered in terms of everything from sound design to the performances of it. Like that movie's really inspiring to me. But the one I'm working on right now is a remake of this Italian movie called Suspiria. And so it's something that we kind of want to take to a new technical level. It's a great like 1970s Dario Argento movie that we're reevaluating and doing some kind of interesting stuff with it. I think it'd be a lot of fun.
Huh. Sounds interesting.
Yeah.
So, one last thing. This was the year that Charles Burnett's film Killer of Sheep finally got a nice release in theaters.
I got to see it. I was so excited.
Am I right in assuming that that's a movie that's been an inspiration to you?
Absolutely. And when I saw that movie, I was like, this is a movie that you can put your hands on and go do it. Like it was inspiring, not only kind of thematically, which it was... I was living in a neighborhood in North Carolina when I saw it for the first time on a print at school. You couldn't get a hold of it, so you'd have to get like 60mm print sent from UCLA to check it out. And we watched it at school, and it really just reminded me of this neighborhood that I was living in. And I really just started looking at my neighborhood with a whole different, just a different take on where I was living and who these kids were after I watched that movie. And it's not only thematically inspiring, but like, It was a movie that doesn't cost a lot of money, and it's far more interesting than movies that do. And there's a movie you can make with your friends, and you can make with a crew that's small and realistic, and you can find a few bucks and go do it. And this guy did it, and it didn't open any sort of blockbuster professional potential for him, but it did lead to a great art house career of admirable work. And I don't know. As a young guy trying to get his foot in the door, when you're looking at the possibilities, like what's realistic, that was far and away of low-budget independent films the most interesting. And people thought that was a little weird for a middle-class white guy to think that was the most interesting, but it was. I couldn't really wrap my head around the kind of early 90s independent film scene as much as I could look back and think of what this guy had done with such modest means and done so profoundly.
Yeah.
But yeah, when I happened to be in Los Angeles when it was re-released, and the first time, it was the first time I'd seen it in 10 years. It was 15 years, I guess. It was pretty amazing.
It's a great, great movie.
Well, that's going to wrap up this edition of the Errata Movie Podcast. You can find us on the web at erratamag.com. That's erratamag.com. And there you'll find other episodes in this series of podcasts, and you can leave us a message or a comment. You can also call 415-287-4020 to leave us a voicemail, or look for us wherever you found this episode. J. Robert Parks will join me next week to talk about the films of Michael Haneke. We'll see you then. Bye.